On this show, we meet people who have carved out success by their own definition. The show is off to a great start, thanks to listeners like you. You've heard me asking you to review and subscribe, and I'm honored that you are doing those things. The show has reached as high as number 3 on the new and noteworthy in the careers category, and 11 in the business category. This is outstanding, and it's helping to bring in new listeners. I wanted to say hello and thank those of you who have reviewed in the iTunes store. Here are a few of those reviews. G's O. Pete says, he's authentic, honest, and tells you what you need to hear, whether through personal philosophy or by interviewing those that espouse the ideals we're all reaching to achieve, making it possible to do what we love, no matter what that looks like to you. Thank you, and hello, G's O. Pete. You've really put into words what I'm trying to do with this show, as does Bradley Spitzer, who says, David is asking great questions to relevant people who have bucked expectations and are charting their own course to their definition of success. I'm hooked. Thank you so much, Bradley. Also, we have Lochlarn JC, who says, loving this new podcast so far. David's work is fantastic, and his first interview with Jason Fried was amazing. Highly recommended. Thank you so much, Lochlarn, and I agree. The interview with Jason Fried really is amazing. I picked him as the first guest for very specific reasons, so if you haven't checked out that episode, please do so. Thanks again to all those reviewers for sharing your thoughts, and those were 5-star reviews, so thank you for that. There's still time for us to climb the new and noteworthy charts in the iTunes store, so please subscribe and review the show. If you love the show, please give it 5 stars. Like to listen to audio? Of course you do. That's what you're doing right now, after all. You're probably also commuting, working out, showering, or some other thing. It's great because you're getting a lot done. And that's really why I love Audible. It gives me access to thousands of audiobooks that I can listen to with my brain while my body is busy. So what it does is it transforms my chores, my commute, and my morning routine into book time. So if you haven't tried it, really, I gotta say, you're missing out. So head to academy.net/audible and get a free Audible audiobook that you can listen to on your smartphone or tablet. And keep in mind, though, that after 30 days, they're going to charge your credit card, and it's only $14.95 a month. But if you cancel before your trial is up, you're going to get to keep your book anyway, and you'll still be supporting the show. So I recommend you start off with How to Win Friends and Influence People. Now, that's not a hint or anything. It's a classic. It will change your life. Or you can choose from 180,000 other titles. Just go to academy.net/audible and claim your free audiobook. Today's guest is someone who has learned the hard way that he wants to retain control of his business. Adrian Holovaty is the founder of SoundSlice, which is interactive music notation for teachers and students. And the interaction of it is incredible, by the way. I recommend that you check it out on soundslice.com. They've got a demo on there. Before SoundSlice, Adrian founded Everyblock, which is hyperlocal news. So he really has a lot of experience with creating structure from chaos. He started on a grant, and he sold it to MSNBC.com. And in an unfortunate turn of events, it got shut down suddenly. So in this episode, Adrian shares some lessons learned from watching, as he puts it, his baby get slaughtered. He shares some useful perspectives for anyone who is on the fence in deciding whether to bootstrap or take funding. Also, if you're someone who struggles with charging for what you create, Adrian's story will be useful to you. As he discovered, making something a viable business from the beginning helps it continue in the future. Here's the interview. I'm here with Adrian Holovaty, and Adrian, we're going to get to all of the amazing accomplishments that you have and all the great things that you've created. But I'm really glad to have you here in the studio today, because I understand that you are about to embark on your first mini life. Is that accurate?
Yeah, in just about a week and a half, I am moving from my longtime home of Chicago to Amsterdam.
And I mean, actually, it's hardly even a mini life. I guess I'm not even using that term correctly, because as I understand, it's about 18 months that you're going to be gone.
18 months, yeah. My wife and I and my 4-year-old son have this golden window, because he's still not old enough to go to school, and my wife's still not working, And I can work from anywhere. So we've always wanted to live in Europe, and now we have this golden opportunity. So we're going to go over there. The original plan was to go for a year, but it took a while to find renters for our house in Chicago, and they insisted on a year and a half. So we're doing a year and a half.
Wow. Okay. So it was originally going to be a year. It's going to be a year and a half. And I mean, it's such an impressive thing that you're able to do that. And I'm sure that there's a lot of people who are really jealous.
It's interesting. Like, I've talked to some very, very successful, you know, according to the traditional definition of success, like people who have sold companies and gone public, and like super like fancy business people, and they're super busy with their lives now. And to a person, every one of them says, wow, I'm so jealous. I wish I could do that. And it just makes you think, like, well, if those people are so successful according to the traditional definitions, maybe the traditional definitions aren't so great.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't mean that's really success.
Absolutely. I mean, I get the same sort of thing sometimes where there'll be a friend where I might even have like a little bit of an inferiority complex over how much more successful they are than I am or something. And they'll sit down with me and they'll be like, oh, wow, it's really cool how you kind of get to do what you want. And I do a lot of mini lives. I actually just arrived from one last night at 1 a.m. I was gone for a month and I was in New York. It really shocked me because it's just like a kind of a normal thing that I do now. It's gratifying, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes it all kind of worth it. I mean, it's definitely difficult because I've been having to deal with getting the visa and packing everything up and getting just stuff in order, but hopefully it'll be worth it.
Yeah. I want to dig into this a little bit more because I know it's one of these things. By the way, mini lives, if you haven't figured it out yet, for those who are listening, is basically like you go to another city, you live your normal life, and that's it. You just go for an extended period of time. 18 months is a really long one. I tend to do like 2 months, 3 months in various cities. I was just wondering, you know, when did you kind of feel like, oh, this is something that I should do?
I've been thinking about it for several years, and the impetus for it, or actually what put me over the edge, was a little mental hack that I did for myself. So my job, what I do to spend my days, is running this online music education site called SoundSlice. And it, for the first 2 years, was just two people. It was me doing the code and my partner, PJ Macklin, who does the design. And I was always doing it full time, and he always had a day job. And after a year or two of that, it became very clear that like he needed to either start doing it full time because he was kind of a bottleneck, or he just needed to like unobligate himself from doing it because everything kind of needed to go through design, and I was just waiting on him for stuff. So we had a heart-to-heart about that, and he decided to do his day job full-time for at least a little bit longer to save up some cash. But anyway, going into that conversation, I told myself I wanted to set myself up for happiness and success either way. So I told myself, if he says yes and he's going to do SoundSlice full-time, I'll be, you know, obviously happy. If he says no, I want to sort of promise myself something so that I'll still be happy to offset the sadness that I get from him not doing it full time. So I said, well, if he doesn't do it full time, that means I'm going to take the family and move to Amsterdam.
Oh, that's cool.
So that means it obviously set me up for happiness either way. It also made that conversation a lot less difficult with PJ because I wasn't like going into it with some, hoping that he would say one thing or the other. I'd be happy either way. And it sort of blames him on the decision, you know. It's convenient because, like, I can just say, well, I made this little mental hack decision to let him decide what I do.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
So as you're having a conversation, you're sort of secretly in the background thinking, like, well, I kind of hope he doesn't even need to...
Well, no, I mean, I would be equally happy if he did it full time. And I mean, I'd stay in Chicago because he's based here too, and we'd work together. By the way, he still might work full time on this at some point in the future. And yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and you'll have a huge time difference. You would have ways to where you would find a way to work together that would be different from the way you would work together here, and you might be surprised what you'd find.
Yeah, we're already sort of set up for working remotely. And the last couple jobs I've had, I've always either been a remote worker or worked with someone who was remote. So I'm super comfortable with that.
Yeah, that's great. And you have a family. So was there ever kind of a point where you were like, well, I can't do this because whether it was the family or any other sort of things where you kind of mental blocks that you had where you thought maybe you couldn't take off, go live somewhere else for an extended period of time?
Yeah, that thought definitely crossed my mind many, many times. And I just talked it over with my wife and we worked it through. She's equally excited about it. And our little guy is excited about it too, especially for the Dutch train system. I mean, he's a little four-year-old guy. He loves trains. So like any new kind of trains is a huge, huge exciting thing for him.
Yeah, there's going to be tons of trains there, right?
Tons of trains.
So you already mentioned SoundSly. So I guess we'll start with that. SoundSlice is amazing. What is SoundSlice for those who aren't familiar?
It's basically web-based music education software. So the premise is that you learn music best if you can hear it and see the music notation at the same time. So traditionally, if you're learning a piece of music, maybe you get a piece of sheet music on paper, or maybe you just have YouTube or iTunes or something open and you're listening to the music. And this is what I've done for many, many years. I've been either listening to a piece of music I want to learn and I reconcile it with a piece of paper that I'm looking at or just try to learn from paper. And SoundSlice combines all of that in one interface. So if you want to learn a piece of music with SoundSlice, you get everything you need as a musician. You've got the sheet music in front of you on a web page. You've got tablature if you're using like a guitar or a fretted instrument. You've got video, you've got audio recordings that are all synced with it, and you can slow them down, you can loop them, you can transpose them, do all this geeky music stuff. And the goal is to be the absolute best way of learning any piece of music.
And you can slow it down too, right? You can kind of pick a section of the music, have it loop, slow it down to halftime, quarter time, things
like
that.
Yeah, yeah, right? Exactly, which is super, super useful for super fast stuff.
Yeah, right. And I'm a guitar player, a beginner, 17 years in the making, or something like that. So yeah, it's really incredible because usually we just have to find these horrible ASCII art tablature things. I mean, I don't want to say totally horrible. I mean, it's great that they're all out there, but you don't get to see the timing. It's just you have to try to scroll as you're playing, and the SoundSlice is such a rich interactive experience, right? Compared to something like that.
Yeah, it's totally modern, you know, so to speak. It's no longer 20th century ASCII stuff. It's actually like taking advantage of the internet and interactivity.
And I think I saw you guys recently launched
that marketplace thing. Yeah, so it's maybe a little bit overwhelming and confusing, the number of things we have on the site. There's actually four parts to the business. There's that marketplace that we just launched a few weeks ago, and that lets any musician sell these online music lessons using our software. It's sort of like, I don't know if you know Udemy, like you can sell courses, but that's very general purpose. This is specifically for musicians, so it's got all the features that musicians need, like that slowdown and music notation, blah blah blah. So let's say you're a music teacher, you teach accordion, you can, to make some extra cash, record some video lessons of your accordion. You can sync up the notation and whatever music stuff you have, and then make that available for sale on SoundSlice. If you set the price, we just take a 30% cut. So there's that part of the site. Then there's the product called SoundSlice for Teachers, which costs $20 a month, and it lets music teachers create these interactive music lessons for their students, and that's intended to complement in-person lessons. Like, I teach here in Chicago at the Old Town School of Folk Music, a weekly guitar class, and I use that with my students. So I'll show them something in class, and then when I get home, I'll give them access to the SoundSlice interactive version, and they all say, oh my God, like, why do I even need to come to class? I just want to use this thing to learn, you know, whatever lick or song I was teaching them. And then we also license the technology to over 20 sites who want to embed it. And then we have a sheet music marketplace. So it sort of all like uses the same technology, but it's different markets and different different bits.
One thing that was very cool that I just heard you mention was that you teach in-person classes at a school here in Chicago as a music school. I've taken some classes there before, and it's just cool to me to hear somebody who works in technology, who's done so much in technology, doing something that doesn't scale much, you know. You're like in person. How did what keeps you doing that?
Well, it's a selfish motivation for wanting to increase the number of gypsy jazz guitar players in the city and in the world. So the class is gypsy jazz guitar. Gypsy jazz is this style of acoustic guitar playing that was basically invented by Django Reinhardt in the 1930s. It's like acoustic swing music. So there's no drums, there's no horns. It's just acoustic guitar, violin, upright bass. It's great, catchy music. Anyway, it's sort of growing in terms of the number of people in the world and in the U.S. who play it, but it's still like a rounding error compared to like rock or blues or whatever.
And you totally are obsessed, love this type of music, apparently.
Yeah, it's so, so good. I've been playing it for like 10 years. I've gotten to study with a lot of people around the world. And in fact, one of the reasons for moving to Amsterdam is that that's basically the number two city in the world for gypsy jazz. Number one being Paris, but I'm not cool enough to live there. And also the language barrier is tough for France, but Holland, it's a lot easier. So gypsy jazz, I just had the opportunity to teach that class, and I said to myself, I want to help increase the number of people who are playing this style of music. It's sort of like the farm team for the Chicago gypsy jazz scene, too. Like, people will take my class, and then they'll start going to the jam sessions here that we have in town and start creating bands and
Okay, so do you participate in these jam sessions as well?
I was at one last night.
Okay, that's cool. Another thing, like, I love these sort of physical space hobbies that people who work in technology can, I mean, because I myself, I'm on a computer most of the time, and I go dancing, you know. It's like this interactive thing you're doing with people, and it totally doesn't scale. It's not being broadcast anywhere, thank goodness. And so it's great to have to do some tactile in-person things like that.
Yeah, I don't think of it as something that's deliberately different from sitting at a computer. I just think of it as something that I love to do. And in fact, I've deliberately changed the thing that I do on the computer to reflect that off-computer passion. So like SoundSlice, which I work on all day long, is all about music at the end of the day.
And I love how then also you are, you know, you're teaching these classes and you're able to use the tool that you created while in the teaching of these classes. So it's this sort of, it's what I think they call in business, they call it synergy, right?
Watch your mouth.
It's a buzzword.
I don't use that word.
It's buzzword bingo, but it's like a really important thing. Yeah, so anyway, it's this thing that it kind of handles two things at once, right?
Yeah.
It's all integrated together. That's very cool. But so SoundSlice is your current endeavor, and you know we can get it. You've done so many other things previous. I hope we have time to get into a few of those. Now, right before SoundSlice, how did you arrive at the SoundSlice idea? Were there other things you were considering in the period of time that you eventually decided to do SoundSlice?
It was to scratch my own itch. So I spent a ton of my free time transcribing old tunes. Actually, this Gypsy Jazz stuff is Django Reinhardt guy. Old recordings from the 30s and 40s where it's obscure enough where you can't just like go to your library or your record store and or your music sheet music store and find transcriptions. You actually have to do the work yourself. So I do a lot of that, and I would, because I don't read music very well, I would create tab of whatever I was transcribing. And by the way, transcribing, just for those who don't know, it's basically taking a recording of music and figuring out which notes were being played and how to play them on your instrument. So I would listen to the recording and use these tools to slow it down and loop it and just really figure out, basically reverse engineering the audio. And after I figured it out, I would write it down. But because I don't really write music, or at least I didn't at the time, I would come back to my writings a week later and I wouldn't even understand what I wrote down. I would need to go reference the real recording again. So to scratch that own itch, to solve that problem, I wanted to make something that would sync the audio recording with the transcription. So I could just press play, I could hear the audio, and I could see the notes light up in real time, synced with the audio. And that's what started Sound Slice.
So did you build sort of like a little prototype just for yourself first?
Yeah, it was in Flash, and I joke that it was the last Flash app ever started, because I started developing it like, oh man, after the Steve Jobs letter, you know, that killed Flash. That version was never public, fortunately. I converted it to HTML5, but yeah, it was just for me.
But Flash helps you, I mean, it was easy to get it done that way, right?
It was the only game in town for doing audio stuff in the web browser.
Oh, okay.
So that was my excuse. Yeah, that was circa 2011. Yeah. So HTML5 audio just was pretty horrible at the time.
Can you recall any other projects you were working on at the time that you were considering might become something that you would pursue full time?
Nope.
That was it.
It was this.
It was just your true love.
It's my true love. I also considered becoming a musician full time. I've been posting YouTube videos of my guitar playing since 2007, and
yeah, you've got millions of views, right?
Yeah, that's actually lucky, because the first ever video I posted, it was the MacGyver theme song on acoustic guitar, and I posted it. I didn't think anything of it, and like nobody looked at it. Maybe like 30 or 40 people, and then a couple months later, somehow it got featured on the YouTube homepage, and I got like more than a million views in a day, and all hundreds and hundreds of comments, and everyone saying like, "You must suck at guitar. The only thing you know how to play is this MacGyver theme song." So that like
sounds like a challenge.
Yeah, exactly. So I got this, you know, fire under me to start posting more stuff, and I got this built-in audience magically because the YouTube gods decided to feature me and give me this small but growing subscriber base. So yeah, I just started doing more and more videos. And anyway, after a few years of that, I just considered, well, maybe I can just do this and somehow find a way to make it work. And now I use Patreon, which I'm really excited about. It's just this way to for people to pledge you like $1 every time you post a video. There's people on there that make like thousands of dollars every time they post a YouTube video. It's amazing. I'm not anywhere near that, but it's something. It's like something that gets me excited about posting.
Oh, it adds a little bit of financial incentive to.
Exactly, yeah. And I can like justify maybe buying a better microphone or getting a guest musician and like splitting the cost with them, splitting the revenue.
Yeah. Cool. And I remember seeing early on when you were like, when SoundSlice launched, I think you were like on the front page of Reddit with one of your guest musicians, I think it would have been.
We were on the front page of Reddit twice. There was the 100 Riffs video, which is actually a Chicago guitar store called the Chicago Music Exchange, where they did this viral video of one guy doing 100 famous rock guitar riffs in a single take. And I transcribed that whole thing and made a SoundSlice version of it, and that's what got to the Reddit homepage. So, yay. It really is the front page of the internet. Like, I was amazed, astounded at how many people, 350,000 people, like, within a couple hours.
Wow.
It's amazing.
And you were prepared for that technologically?
Yeah. The site didn't break a sweat. And we were also on the homepage for another thing. I want to say a transcription of solo guitar Bohemian Rhapsody. I actually forget what the other one was. But yeah, it's the kind of thing where if you see SoundSlice in action, even if you're not a musician, you can really appreciate like, whoa, that sort of shows me behind the curtain how to play something.
So yeah, it sounds like you're the SoundSlice thing that you're doing right now is you're, like I was saying, your perfect true love or something. It's got, you know, this music aspect to it. You're using technology in a really interesting way to solve a problem that was important to you. You don't have investors, right? You have total control over it.
Total control. No investors. We've turned down investors. We've turned down acquisition offers. I want to do this forever. not just from a music standpoint, but the tech is incredibly interesting. Just making a sheet music rendering engine in JavaScript is a huge, interesting problem. It's a combination of art and science. It's taking literally hundreds of years worth of special cases and encoding them. In 1790, they decided to start using this one squiggly in this weird situation of music. So you have to, you know, make a rule for that in your engraving engine. It's quite interesting. And then there's the whole aspect of automatic music transcription, which is something we don't do yet, but I hope to at some point, where you would give it an MP3 and it would automatically tell you how to play it. There are services that do that, but they're all woefully inaccurate this day and age.
I feel like I remember talking to you about this in like 2008 or 2009 or something that. And then revisiting, I remember asking you about it maybe a couple of years ago, and you're like, oh yeah, that thing, and that'll never happen. But now it seems like you're a little more optimistic.
It'll happen. Maybe it's my retirement project. It'll happen in our lifetime. It'll happen sometime after autonomous cars are common on the streets, because it's like an AI level problem.
Yeah.
There's a lot that the computer needs to understand in order to do that.
I mean, like you were just mentioning all the different types of notation. I mean, yeah, there's basic things like quarter notes and eighth notes and 16th notes and pauses and such. But it sounded like you were mentioning there's also these other obscure things that, you know, this sort of rendering engine would have to be able to interpret.
Well, there's the rendering, and then there's just figuring out what's happening in the audio. So the tough nut to crack in audio, from what I understand, is when you have multiple instruments or voices playing at the same time. Mm-hmm. Because just due to physics, you have harmonics of an audio signal sort of overlapping another instrument's harmonics, and it's very, very hard for a machine to split those. The human ear is really, really good at it, so it's definitely possible, but it is very, very hard and an unsolved problem for computers.
Yeah. So you're now settled into this endeavor that's doing pretty well, it looks like, and it's this thing that you want to do for the rest of your life. How did you arrive here? Were there certain lessons that you learned from previous endeavors that have you now in this happy place, or?
Hollow laughter. Insert hollow laughter. So previously I had started this company called Every Block, which was a newsfeed for your city block. So the premise is you enter your address, and we give you a newsfeed of everything happening right around that address. And that's intended for urban areas where there's a lot of stuff happening. So we started that in 2007, and it was originally funded by a grant. The grant went away, and it got acquired by MSNBC.com, and it ran for, I think, 3 more years, and then MSNBC itself got acquired by NBC News, and NBC News decided to shut down Every Block and fire everyone. So I got a pretty bad taste in my mouth from that experience. It's a bit difficult to talk about, because I benefited from it financially, obviously, and that's what gave me the freedom to start working on SoundSlice and bootstrap it before it started making money. So I'm eternally grateful for that. But at the same time, I learned that I wouldn't want to go through that process again. And I'll just emphasize, it's hard to try to thread the needle with that, because it can sound like it's It can sound very privileged to say, oh yeah, my company was acquired, so I made a bunch of money, but I would never
do it again.
Do that again.
And they did it all wrong. And
yeah. Exactly. So I want to be very gentle and just careful in talking about that. But if I were to do every block again, I would definitely have a business model from the get-go. So the site never really made any money. I blame that on myself. I also sort of blame it on the situation, because it was funded by a grant, and the foundation that gave us the grant had advised us not to worry about making money. Mm-hmm. That's why we gave you a grant, so you wouldn't have to worry about making money. So it sort of started it off on the wrong foot. But I don't want to do that again.
Yeah. So just to review all of that, I know. So there was a grant that you were given, mm-hmm. when you first had this idea, and so you got this money to keep it going, and we were advised not to worry about the revenue because you had the grant, right?
Right. Yeah. So. That got us started in that mindset, that it was sort of like this academic thing, where this experimental thing, where it's we're making this thing for the newspaper industry to see if this idea is worth pursuing, as opposed to making a business.
Yeah, and the idea, for those who aren't familiar, is like, a newsfeed, everything that happened on your block, it would scan all the news articles and various things, and it would tell you exactly what was going on your block, right?
Yeah, we scanned so many different sources, hundreds of news sources, so mainstream media plus blogs plus message boards. We got stuff like Flickr photos, Yelp reviews, Craigslist postings, public records like crimes, new businesses, restaurant inspections, stuff that people posted directly to the site, like, hey, did anyone hear that loud noise? What was that? And that sort of became the most popular use of the site, which is this neighborhood message board kind of service. Yeah, it was this cornucopia of interesting, sometimes not interesting stuff that had to do with your immediate area.
So it was this hyper-local news thing, and at the time, when you got the grant, I'm sure there was a lot of speculation about, and that's why you got the grant, was a lot of speculation about what is this thing going to be, this idea of hyperlocal news. How much of that, can you remember any of the sort of predictions or projections people had about that, or that you had about that, and how have those panned out from what the expectations were for this idea of hyperlocal news?
Well, at one point there, it was definitely a trend. I forget if that was like before we started or after we started. So we were certainly riding that. Although I did it because it was something that it was, again, an itch I wanted to scratch. So living in Chicago, despite it being a huge city with so much going on, almost in spite of that, or because of that, rather, there's not a really easy way of finding everything happening. So the big newspaper, the Tribune and the Sun-Times, wouldn't really cover my neighborhood park, say. So there wasn't a really good place to do it. So, I think one of the main reasons we got the grant was that the news industry was interested in that kind of idea. And the foundation that gave us the grant wanted us to be the testing ground for that.
And so eventually the grant money started to dry up. Was that, when you first got the grant money, was there any thought that like, oh, there will be another grant, or was there thinking about how that would continue after the grant?
Yeah, we thought about a lot of different possibilities. So one was we get another grant, and we just sort of get on that treadmill, and every couple of years we have to do more grant writing or
And then you're really just sweating about getting those grants
exactly
accepted and going through, right?
Yeah, so there was that. We considered just shutting it down once the grant went away, but there were enough users and enough interest that we decided not to do that. We considered doing the VC thing. I talked to some investors. We considered bootstrapping it, and then we talked to a bunch of companies about buying it. So, and by buying it, it basically that meant they would hire us and let us keep working on it.
Yeah, right. And then eventually, the deal with MSNBC happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that deal happens, so that deal happened, and then another deal happened, and then there was kind of
fiasco.
Things that happened that didn't really, you know, that you didn't foresee, and all sorts of different.
Yeah, that's one bit of advice that I give to people who are considering getting acquired. You may think, and actually know that the people you're dealing with at the acquiring company are really great people. And in fact, that was the case for us at MSNBC.com. The people who did that deal, the people who were running MSNBC.com at the time, were and continue to be amazing people that I really respect.
Now, MSNBC.com is different from MSNBC,
or was at
the time, or...
Yeah, that was... It's kind of a confusing thing. The website was its own brand that tried to do straight, unbiased news, whereas the cable channel had a liberal spin on things. So that was a constant source of just internal struggle. And that's one of the reasons that they rebranded as NBC News.
Gotcha. Okay.
So anyway, yeah, I tell people like, yeah, you know, you want to be careful in vetting people who will acquire you. But at the end of the day, they're not necessarily going to be there forever. They might get bought out themselves, or they might go find other jobs. And there's no guarantee that anything will stay happy forever.
Right. I mean, because you're dealing with a whole other entity, you know. You're dealing with a person, and that person may see things similarly to the way you do, but ultimately they are working for an entity that has no particular views or values necessarily other than to shareholder value, mostly, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And if I remember right what happened, and I remember this day where it was just like, I think it was on the top of Hacker News, which is a really popular news aggregator for those who aren't familiar. It was just on the top of Hacker News or something that like every block just disappeared.
Yeah, it was quite amazing. They just shut it down one day and fired everyone and just took the site down. There was no What's the term I'm looking for? Edit this out.
There was no warning.
There was no warning given to the site users. It just went away one day. There was no access to archives. There was no read-only stuff. Just every page was redirected to a message saying the site is no longer around. So that in itself was really poorly done. And I could rant about this, but I don't want to like put people to sleep.
Sure.
Then the other kind of interesting thing is that so NBC News shut it down, and NBC is owned by Comcast. And a year later, Comcast decided to bring it back. So they brought the site back, and everything was still there. Like, they brought it back, they turned it back on, and all the old stuff was still there.
All the data.
User accounts still worked. I can't think of another example in the history of the internet where, like, a not a huge, but a reasonably sized site went away, and then a year later, it came back, and nothing had changed. It's kind of eerie.
Yeah, I mean, it was a popular enough site. I remember seeing bus shelter ads.
Yeah, we did the bus shelter ads. We did CTA, the train ads. We did door hangers in certain neighborhoods. Yeah, we tried a lot of different marketing stuff.
It was a beautiful product, beautiful design.
Yeah, the designers were super awesome.
And and it just sort of disappeared overnight. And I mean, I know this is hard to talk about, Adrian. I know because we've talked about it before, but you know, how did that feel?
Well, of course, it feels horrible. It feels horrible for many ways, for many reasons. You've got the human aspect where I think there were 12 people working on it and they were all, you know, jobless. Of course, they're good at what they do, so it's not like, and web developers are in demand, so it wasn't like a huge nightmare for them, but it's still like bad news to be
this
laid
thing
off.
That they probably loved working on,
of course,
too.
And then there's the product, and just having that that feeling that you've disappointed many, many users of the site, and like you've lost their trust, even though you weren't in control anymore, so you're not really to blame. But I mean, I was one of the figureheads of the site, so like, you know, it reflects on me. Like, all of a sudden, the site's gone. What? And then just the utility of having, of not having the site anymore, was bad.
Yeah. Right.
Trifecta of badness.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, it was just gone, and the users probably felt disappointed, and you didn't have the right to bring it back up. It was completely out of your hands. It belonged to somebody else at that point, right?
Exactly. And one thing that really was sort of like the salt in the wound, or the knife deep in your gut being twisted, was the fact that the person in charge of NBC News had opportunities to sell it. And I knew for a fact that at least one company had inquired about EveryBlock and wanted to buy it before they shut it down. And NBC never returned their emails. So the conspiracy theory is that NBC didn't want to have it be owned and operated by somebody else and see it have success there, because then people would say, well, NBC couldn't make it work. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, some sort of internal political
some dumb politics
issue,
yeah.
That- You know, who knows what sort of interpersonal relationships were a part of that dynamic within the companies, right?
Right. And
you just have no way of knowing.
For a news organization, especially, where in theory you pride yourself on ethics and truth, it was a really bad scene by those the people in charge there, because they lied to the media about it. They said, "Yeah, we tried to sell it, but nobody was interested," where I know for a fact that company was interested and they didn't return their emails.
Yeah. Eesh. So just really quickly, though, it is back up.
It
now,
is back
right?
up.
People want to use
it. It's operated by some zombie staff in Philadelphia, of all places, as opposed to Chicago, which where it used to be operated. I have no involvement. I do get the daily email, and I enjoy reading it, but the product has stagnated, and I'm skeptical about it.
Sure. Well,
yay.
And you know, it sounds. Thanks for sharing it. I know it's like such a painful thing to probably relive. You know, but one of the things I find, you know, for myself or for a lot of people who are really successful is that. You know, your valleys are your peaks in a way, that like the things that are the most painful end up informing what you do in the future, right?
Totally. That has completely molded me into one of these, I don't know what the word is, indie, you know, bootstrapper, self-sustainable, make a sustainable thing, work on what you love and don't sell out. That kind of person. And I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah, right?
Totally.
I mean, look at all this. You're gonna go live in Amsterdam for a year and a half. You know, you couldn't have done that probably when you were running EveryBlock.
Right, yeah. There were 12 people working on it, and I don't know, maybe I could have convinced people to let me do that. But
might have looked kind of bad to the people who were...
Totally.
Giving you the money. Like, say if you were working, it was MSNBC.com right after the acquisition, if you were like, well.
Right. Yeah, that
would not have been
cool. I don't think they would have gone for that.
Yeah, so now you've got this thing that you totally love to do and you want to do for the rest of your life, as you've said.
Yeah.
That's great. So, and I also want to make sure that we don't miss, like, the one thing. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are familiar with Sound Slice. There's a lot of people who are familiar with every block. But I would posit that the one thing that has probably touched the most people who are listening to this is Django. Not Django Reinhardt, the jazz musician that you were just – gypsy jazz musician you were just talking about. But Django, the Python framework.
Yeah, the geek thing.
Yeah, the geek thing. And there's probably a few people who know what Django is who are listening to this. But in layman's terms, what is Django?
It's a tool that lets computer programmers make websites more quickly. So when you access a website, chances are you're interfacing with a computer program on the other side. So you visit google.com or amazon.com, and it's actually a computer program that's returning you those web pages. And that computer program is written usually using a bit of software called a web framework. And Django is one of many web frameworks.
It's a framework on top of Python, right?
And so yeah, it uses the Python programming language.
Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of things that would be normally really complicated to do really quite simple.
Yeah, and not necessarily complicated, just kind of maybe boring, or things that you don't want to have to do every time you make a website like that. Yeah. It just does that for you.
Yeah, I personally, like, I worked for a couple of different companies that had web applications that were built in Java. And so I was, like, the front-end developer, and there would be – sometimes there would be user-generated content. So there would be situations where – just perfect example where people would put a URL in a review they had written on a proct or something, and I'd say, well, I want to make these URLs just automatically clickable. And – I'd say that to the engineering team, and they'd kind of be like, well, I mean, this is going to take us like 3 weeks, or, you know, do you really need to do that? And then, like, me as the front end developer and also product manager and designer, like, this is a decision that I should be able to make and just make it happen, right? Now, when I finally worked with Django, I was so excited because I could just write like one word and that would be a preference, and I could change a bunch of different things about it, and I could do that right in the template layer, right in the front part of everything, and it was just so much more simple.
Exactly, yeah.
And so because of that, Django is outrageously popular on the internet, right? I mean, do you have any idea how many sites use Django?
I don't, and in fact, there's no way of knowing because we don't put any sort of code or hidden thing in a website so that you can tell that it's running Django or not.
Yeah,
I would estimate, I don't know, high tens of thousands. I don't know, maybe I'm way off. That order of magnitude.
No, I do know that at one point, like, Yelp.com used Django. I'm trying to think of any others.
You know, I didn't know about Yelp, but
pretty sure that they did for a while.
Instagram.
Back in the early days.
Instagram, Pinterest. What are some other big ones? The Firefox update thing, like if you use Firefox and you update your browser, it'll hit a site powered by Django. Yeah.
And it's an open source project, so there's thousands of contributors to it that keep it running. You know, your involvement in it these days, what is?
I retired. So two of us were the so-called benevolent dictators for life. That did not end up being true. We were not the dictators for life. We were benevolent dictators for the first 8 or 9 years of the project, and then we decided that we should just let the community run it by consensus.
Yeah.
So that meant that for the first, eight-ish years, the other guy, Jacob Kaplan-Moss, and I would be basically the arbiters, the decision makers for contentious decisions about how the framework should be designed. And it ended up being the case that, number one, Jacob and I didn't really have enough time to work on it anymore. And number two, we didn't really need, the community didn't really need us anymore because the rough consensus ended up being a good way of running it.
Mm-hmm. And long story short, I think the way Django happened was you were working at an online newspaper. Mm-hmm. And you were having to do all this programming anyway, and this made it easier, right?
Yeah, you know, if you work at a newspaper, it's a very, very deadline-driven environment, obviously. So, you know, some news happens, and all of a sudden you're forced to drop everything and work on that in a matter of hours, you know, for publication deadline. So out of that environment, I was working as a web developer in that environment, and my boss would say, hey, some big breaking news happened. Please make a database for this in an hour. And it was just these very, very tight deadlines. And out of necessity, we started making some tools that let us build those sort of sites very quickly. And we made one site, and then we made a second site, and we figured out, oh, well, these two sites have something in common, so let's extract that commonality. And then we made a third site, and oh, that site was a little bit different, so we added some more features, but let's extract that commonality. And once you make dozens and dozens of sites and products, you end up having this common code that ends up being a framework. Yeah. And that's what we open sourced after about 2 years of using it internally.
Oh, okay. And was that a difficult decision to get past to make it open source?
I thought it would be, but my boss, to his eternal credit, was totally cool with it almost instantly. The other guy, Simon Wilson, and I made a list of all the reasons we should open source, and we, you know, deliberated over it, and we carefully planned it and wrote down some notes and set up
how
our meeting.
How you were going to pitch it, you planned.
Exactly, yeah. The pitch. And, you know, we had a bullet list of, you know, however many, a dozen reasons. And by the time we got to, like, the second or third, Rob, the boss, was like, yeah, let's do it. So it was actually an easy sell.
That's great.
Yeah.
Were there any lessons that you learned from the Django experience that you can think of that have informed what you're doing today or what you did later with EveryBlock?
Yeah, two lessons I can think of. Number one is the power of design. So it was open sourced in 2005. And it's hard to imagine, maybe, if you're in any way involved in web development or open source these days. But at the time, open source projects were horrendously designed. I'm talking about their websites. It was the era of SourceForge, which has an atrocious design. It was the era of just like completely unstyled web pages, like a normal H1 and like Times New Roman on any open source project. So the fact that we had a beautifully designed site by Wilson Miner, who designed it, even though that's completely nothing to do with the quality of the code itself, that got a lot of people looking at it.
Oh, wow.
The second thing is the importance of packaging. For the first, I don't know how long, maybe a year of Django, the only way to get it was to check out the Subversion repository. So in layman's terms, that means you have to how can I explain this in layman's terms? There was no like Django version 1, download this zip file. It was Django as of 2 minutes ago, the latest commit number 3647. So I'm running 3647. You're only running 2900.
There's this bug in mine.
Exactly. So the solution is always
figure this out.
Just run the latest one. Just update your code. And for some reason, people did not like that. Well, you know, some people did, but those are the hardcore users. And as soon as we packaged it up and made a proper version number, then the...
Was that a new thing to say, like, oh, this is the stable version?
It was not a new thing. I mean, that's been happening in open source for a long time. It's just not ignorance per se, but just... I wasn't excited about packaging something up. I wanted it to just be the living, breathing thing. And the other part B to that is once we launched version 1.0, then we were cooking with oil. Then people really started to download it and use it. And that's because in the open source world, the way version numbers generally work is once there's a 1.0, there's sort of this expectation that it's stable and that it's not going to change in future versions. So before we had 1.0, we had 0.9, 0.91, and those versions did not guarantee backwards compatibility, which meant if you downloaded that and you built something with it And then we came up with a new version.
It might break.
It might break.
Yeah.
So once we had 1.0, we promised that it wouldn't break.
So you learned from that experience to sort of package things. How have you applied that in the later endeavors?
Marketing kind of thing. So for SoundSlice, I am constantly adding new stuff, new features, new fixes, every day, several times a day. I mean, it's a website, so I'm from the generation that believes that you should update a website, you know, constantly, and that's part of the awesomeness of the internet, unlike the App Store, where you have to bow down for the Apple gods and wait a week before they can okay your change. So I'm constantly making changes, but the lesson is don't just, like, make these changes and announce them piecemeal, package them up in releases. So even though I launched a new feature 2 weeks ago, I'm going to wait to talk about it with this package of features that's much more impressive and newsworthy if you wait and package things up.
Right. Makes it a collective event that people can share with each other and discuss. And that gets attention.
Yeah, it's just
not always
front
page of Reddit, but
yeah, not always front page, but it's a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, you've had so many really successful projects: Django, Every Block, SoundSlice. I imagine you probably have piles of tons and tons of other little experiments and things that you've played with on the side that didn't turn into things, or.
Yeah, of course.
Does everything you touch turn to gold?
No, there's like silly stuff. So, what's the one example? One example is the YouTube insult generator. That was just a stupid little joke. So the premise there was, you know how on YouTube there's like the number of thumbs up and thumbs down?
Yes.
And sometimes people in the comments will say, if there's like 12 thumbs down on the video of the Beatles Help song, some witty person will put a comment, 12 people need help. You know, they'll like right. make a reference. And
yes.
So I saw that emerging thing and made a search engine. So you type in any like topic, like you type the Beatles and it would find all the comments that started with a number and had a verb in them, like 12 people need help, 15 people are Yoko Ono, or something like that.
Right.
And it would replace the number with the word you, and it would basically make insults. It was basically just an experimental joke more than anything else. But
you know, the irony of this is that a YouTube comment actually motivated you to make more of your gypsy jazz videos, when in fact YouTube comments should be given no credence whatsoever, which I'm sure you just hadn't learned at that point, probably.
Yeah, that took a little too long for me to learn.
Hey, but good things came from it. Anyway, so the YouTube comment generator, any others?
Yeah, I made a thing called Trodo.com. It was this guy's, John's idea back in 2002. And the premise was that it was basically like a eBay for bartering. So you could say, I've got this CD available, please, and I'll make it available for like one Trodo pointer. It basically was like an online marketplace for bartering.
Yeah.
And it never went anywhere.
Sounds like a virtual currency, too.
I don't think there was any currency involved. I think it was just straight barter, and you would have, like, credits for how much you bartered. But that never went anywhere.
Cool. All right, well, now thanks for sharing all this stuff in this conversation. Now, I've got a number of, I guess I'll call them canned questions, or questions that are a little bit quicker.
Can me.
Yeah, sure. Let's do it. All right. When do you feel the greatest sense of flow? And if I need to explain flow to you.
Oh, yeah, I got it. Ragtime music.
Ragtime music?
When I need to get stuff done on a deadline, I put on the Scott Joplin. It's my secret, man.
And And that's your secret weapon, is Scott.
It's not a secret anymore.
Oh no, now it's out.
I put on the not just Joplin. I've gotten into other ragtime composers, and it's got the perfect combination of humanity. The music is so human and beautiful and emotional, but it's not too human. It's not too emotional. I mean, this is music that can be performed by a player piano, by a machine. So it's got a fair amount of repetition and sort of mechanical sound. And that balance of humanity and mechanicalness, for some reason, makes me boogie in terms of the productivity.
I haven't listened to a bunch of ragtime, but I do think I might be off here, but there's a Skip James album from like 1937 or something. You know who I'm talking about? Skip James?
No, I gotta check
like
it out.
Like a blues, mostly known for guitar, but he's got some piano stuff.
Okay.
That I think it's like ragtime style. Huh. It's like an old blues guy. You know, he did, you might have, if you've ever seen Ghost World, there's this song, you never seen the movie Ghost World, okay.
No.
All right, well, there's this song in there, Devil Got My Woman Blues.
Okay.
And anyway, that's who Skip James is, but he's got some stuff that sounds a little ragtimey. But so it doesn't matter what you're doing, but you put on the ragtime music. And
ragtime
you're like,
piano,
oh,
yeah. Ragtime guitar, piano. I don't think that would really work as well. But yeah, ragtime piano, that's what I do.
And it doesn't matter what you're doing. There's no particular...
Yeah, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. Well, assuming that my task does not involve audio. Like right now, for instance, today, this morning, I was editing some audio and video, and unfortunately, you can't just listen to music during that because you need to...
It's difficult, yeah.
Yeah.
Listen to music.
It's kind of impossible.
Edit audio. It's, yeah, some would call it impossible, I think. So all this seems to go so naturally for you, and you've, you know, reached this point where you're really comfortable in your skin with what you're doing. You've found something that you kind of want to do for the rest of your life. But, you know, were there any of these things that you weren't very good at first that... you kind of had to learn to get where you are, or were there things that you weren't very good at first that you decided, like, actually it's better that I don't do that anymore?
Oh, of course. Everything. One big one is the, it sounds so dumb, but the premise of making something that people pay for. So my training, my undergraduate degree is in journalism. And they hammer it into your skull that you're not allowed to think about making money. Mm. That's what the business people are for. There's the so-called Chinese wall between the editorial team and the advertising team. And you are not allowed to even think about how the newspaper makes money. You would get in trouble if you even considered it. And, you know, that's what we were trained in school. So you just, like, get that mentality. And it took me years to get rid of that. I remember when we were thinking about Every Block business models, I felt guilty for thinking about how we're going to make money.
Yeah.
So that took me years to shake. And I still have a little pang of guilt, although it's mostly gone away. But it's, you know, it...
You're comfortable with... You've become more comfortable with capitalism.
Yeah, more comfortable. And the way I think about it is... If you like something, you want to see it continue to exist, so give them some money so they can continue to exist. That's the argument I use when I'm trying to convince someone to pay for SoundSlice, and it's also an argument I use with myself when I'm trying to think about whether I should buy something or, you know, subscribe to some service. Do I like this enough that I want to see it exist, continue to exist?
Yeah, and you know, you probably learned a little bit with Every Block.
Totally.
For that. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Just that this great thing that you wanted to keep having exist, but the money wasn't there for it at some point, or at least because you weren't thinking about the money, then you weren't able to keep it sustaining itself.
Yeah.
And that's also interesting that, you know, you brought up that your training is in journalism. You're such a talented technologist. Where did all that come from? Was that just sort of on the side?
Yeah, that's on the side. My dad is a computer programmer, so I grew up around that stuff. I always have been playing with computers. I made my first program in high school on the TI-85 calculator, like, did all the formulas for math class. A math, Adrian's math. And I loved it, and I did a computer science minor, although I didn't finish the minor. So I learned web development in college.
I mean, and at this point, it doesn't seem like there's, you know, with Django and every block, there was this journalism theme there. And there doesn't seem to be a big journalism theme to SoundSlice. Is there any, where is what you've learned from learning to be a journalist in what you're doing now?
Oh, good question. So I see it as creating structure from chaos. That's that's really why I was interested in journalism. It's this premise that you go out into the world and you just figure out what's going on and you distill it into information that people can understand easily. So that's why I really like programming. It's taking a complex world and distilling it into a line-by-line algorithm. That's why I like transcribing music. It's taking this complex just audio signal and getting the underlying notes, the symbolic information. So I love taking rasterized information, if that's the right word, or stuff that's, you know...
And vectorizing it.
And vectorizing it, exactly. So that modeling, funny. I guess, is the word.
That's funny. That's something that my brain has so much trouble with, I think. Like, the first time that I, you know, saw music notation, not that I totally get it now, but just the idea that, oh, I heard this song, and it was great, but then you see there's actual notes and structure to this that you could follow and recreate it. It just seems like impossible. Or in journalism, where there's an event that happens, and then now you have to... Now you have to state a number of facts, and the things that you say have to be facts. And if they're not facts, then there are certain words that you have to use, like alleged, or you know, to be very precise about taking this thing that seems a little nebulous to some people and giving it structure.
Yeah, that's what I always saw my job as when I was doing journalism stuff, is creating structure from chaos.
What was the biggest compromise that you think that you've had to make?
It was tough leaving every block. There's probably two every block things. Number one, the acquisition, and number two, when I left. For the acquisition, it was in a way quite uncomfortable because we were funded by a grant, yet we then got acquired. So there were no investors, and in fact, the foundation had no equity in it. So it made for a weird...
It was all yours, but this foundation had given you money to build this thing, but you had to keep it alive. You wanted to keep it alive.
Right. And in fact, something that not a lot of people know is the foundation had to convince me to take the grant. I was actually a little bit skeptical about it because that must have been in 2007. I was very... risk averse. I mean, I had never done anything really entrepreneurial. I was working for a bunch of newspapers. I had this opportunity to get the grant, and you know, it was $1.1 million. That's a ton of money. And despite that, they sort of had to walk me through and convince me over the phone. And one of the things they said was, you know, well, one of my concerns was, well, what happens when the grant goes away? And they said, well, you can do whatever you want. I mean, your obligations to us are done. You can continue working on it. You can shut it down. You can go, you know, turn it into a business, sell things. And they only cared that we fulfill the obligation, which was we launch it in 10 cities and we open source the code. So that was my MO, like going out of the grant period. It was sort of following their advice, but still, despite that, it's sort of a weird situation. So, and then the second thing was when I left every block. I mean, if something, I was the main dude who founded it, and it's a very weird situation when you leave your baby because it wasn't shut down at that point. It was still going. It wasn't going to be shut down for another maybe, I don't know, 5 months. So that's a very difficult decision, and it's hard to do that and not disillusion the other people working on it, because like if they see, oh, the founder is going away, what does that mean for the site? Like, is that a vote of no confidence or what?
Yeah, right. And so when you took the grant money, was that sort of like the moment that you became an entrepreneur? Were you doing entrepreneurial things before?
I had launched a bunch of side projects, but none of them were entrepreneurial. The most direct one related to EveryBlock was a site called ChicagoCrime.org that did, it was basically like EveryBlock, but only crimes and only Chicago. So you would type in your address and see the crimes near you with Google Maps, and it was one of the original Google Maps mashups when that was a thing. But that didn't have any business model. I remember I did a presentation of it at the Chicago Tribune, and they asked me the business model, and I said, it costs like $40 or $50 in server costs a month, and I can justify paying for that. I don't need to make any money on it. And like, they were astounded by that. Like, they're like, what? Why wouldn't you want to make money? And I was still in that J school mentality at that point.
Yeah. Were there any things that you did, you know, when you were a child or something that you would look back on and say, oh, that kind of makes sense why I'm doing the things that I'm doing now, considering that I did this weird thing when I was a kid?
Yeah. I mentioned a couple minutes ago that I made this program called AMath for the calculator.
Oh, right. High school. Yeah.
And I became obsessed with
it. It was an unusual thing for somebody to be doing at that age, maybe.
Yes and no. For like the advanced math students, a couple of us were programming. But the thing that I really remember vividly about that was I would go home and optimize the heck out of that program. Like, because
so space, it would run faster.
So it would run faster, and so that it would take up less memory, because memory space on these calculators was at a premium.
Right.
So I would like rename variables so that they were only a single character, so that it would chop off a couple of bytes. And then I would increment the version number because I thought that was so cool. Like, okay, I'm on version 2.0.92, and distribute that to people. And I just got really hooked on that, iterating on software and seeing people use it in the real world. Because people would come up to me in the hallways like, hey, thanks for AMath.
Were these like the TI-82s?
85s,
the
yeah.
The
TI-85s. 85, oh yeah.
They're still out there, I think, and they're still...
I still have mine.
Still expensive.
Dude, it still uses the same batteries. The batteries haven't run out, and I graduated high school in 1998. I can't believe it. That something about those batteries...
That's incredible.
It's amazing.
Seem like that should work. That doesn't seem like that should work at all. Were there any... like, what was like the shittiest job that you ever had?
Data entry.
Oh, okay.
I did a lot of data entry in high school. And that was, let's see, I did a whole bunch of different ones. One was typing up mortgages. So we got a huge stack of mortgage paperwork, and you would have to look at each one and find the data from it. So find the amount of the mortgage, find the person's name and the bank's name, basically creating structured data out of it and using these horrible 1970s terminals to add the data.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah. That was a popular job, I think, for high school and college students in the 90s. I grew up in Omaha. I remember seeing a lot of data entry jobs. I ended up doing telemarketing, inbound telemarketing.
Oh, wow.
But I remember having to deal with one of those like little terminal program things where that was fascinating to me, because you'd get to see like, oh, so they gave us all like really crappy computers, so that's cheap. And then they made this tiny program that can work on it, and it's a pain to use, but it's economically really efficient.
Right.
But yeah, sitting in the chair and doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, kind of soul crushing. I never did work in the food industry, so I definitely privileged in that way. I didn't have a truly bad job.
So yeah, that's good. I haven't been a waiter or anything like that either, so maybe it's something I should try for some humility.
For your next mini life.
For my next mini life. I've considered it. That would make a good reality TV show, huh? So I think you've probably talked about a couple times of this, but just to formalize it, when have you left money on the table? And if that has happened, what do you feel like you got in return for leaving the money on the table?
A couple of SoundSlice customers have requested to outright buy our software as opposed to paying the monthly licensing fee. Mm-hmm. And they were offering, you know, decent chunks of change for that ability, but I decided not to do it because it's too complicated in terms of the technical aspects. I wouldn't want to do that just to get a one-time chunk of change. Mm-hmm. Also, a couple of companies have been interested in just buying SoundSlice outright, and I've just said no. So what I'm losing there, obviously, is just like the financial stuff.
And what do you feel like you're gaining from leaving the money on the table?
The ability to not see my baby slaughtered. To put it in a not so classy way. I don't want to see, I don't ever want that to happen again, where something that I've made is bought and I can no longer influence it or control it, and it either is shut down or it just turned ugly. Like these days, every block is, they've done some horrible things to the design. They've added these buttons that just completely clash with the design. It just looks horrible, like a junior high student had designed it.
Yeah, just, and you don't like the feeling of seeing that happen, and you don't have any control over it at all.
Exactly.
And you get to have this, you got to do something all day, every day, right? So,
I can't just sit somewhere and drink, a root beer, which is my preferred beverage, or ginger ale. I need to be contributing to the world.
And you're obviously a very productive person. Is there any particular way that you structure your days or your weeks or your months?
Just working. I go to an office from around 10 to 5. I spend some time with the family in the morning, spend some time with the family at night, and then after my son goes to bed, do a little bit more work, or I practice music, or maybe I record a YouTube video. And other than that, there's no formal structure. I never watch TV. I am guilty. My wife sort of makes fun of me for this. I'm guilty of not doing anything that I think is sort of a waste of time. And I'm pretty strict in what I define as being a waste of time. Like TV is kind of a waste of time.
I have that. I don't know if I should call it a problem or not, but I have that a little bit too. But I do watch some shows and stuff, but I know I was meeting with some friends and friends of friends, and they had met in a board game meetup. Mm-hmm. Now, and I was really fascinated by the idea that they got together and played board games, which I think would probably be a lot of fun. But for me, it's very difficult for me to get into a board game, I think, because I'm just completely thinking the whole time that you know, okay, why am I getting good at this one?
Yeah.
Are you like that as well?
I like, hanging out with friends and
that part of it would be nice. But,
and I like winning, so I do like board games. But generally, like TV, sports. I was a huge Bulls fan here in Chicago when I was a kid, but I don't watch any sports at all.
You know, I had that too. I grew up in Nebraska, where college football is huge, and so I got sucked into that, and I would watch it, and I would go to the college that I went to. I'd go to their football games, their basketball games. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would be really into it. I think it was about the time that I went abroad to Italy for a semester, and I didn't have access to sports. That was the time when I think I just stopped watching entirely. And now it makes it difficult to live in Chicago because it's such a sports town, and people right. want to know who you're for.
I've got two maybe controversial or not PC thoughts on that. I think sports fans, painting with very, very broad strokes.
With that caveat in mind. Come on, let's hear it.
If you're really, really into sports, chances are you're not the type of person who like really gets into working on something and really putting your life into it.
Yeah.
Because if you're something, if you're a person like that, there's no room for sports in an obsessive way. Like I'm talking about like people who go to every game, they watch every game.
Yeah.
Like it's such a time commitment and an energy and brain commitment that you just don't have enough room left for really being super into what you're creating.
Right. Put in and broad strokes, of course.
Put in broad strokes, of course.
Don't want to offend any sports fans out there who really create things.
And then the other super offensive thing is maybe one reason people like sports is that, and also with TV is, you know, that it's that social lubricant. It gives you something to talk about with other people. And I definitely miss out on that. Like sometimes when I'm out with friends and they're talking about whatever the heck the new HBO or Netflix show is, I have no idea what they're talking about. And I just sit there stupidly.
And you like to be a part of the conversation, you know, it would be nice.
Yeah, but I mean, I justified that and sort of, I turn it into a competitive thing, like just in my mind, like, well, those guys are wasting their time.
Sure.
And in doing that.
Yeah, I think of it like smoking, you know, people who smoke, they can hang out outside and they can be social with, they can meet people and stuff. I want to start a craze of just like dipping carrots and hummus, and you have to it's not allowed indoors, so you have to do it outside, and you just, you know, you meet outside the door and you're like, hey, you got any hummus? Oh no, I don't have any hummus.
I do have carrots
though. Can I bum a carrot off you? It would be like be like a healthy sort of social lubricant thing that would be
okay.
And I hardly drink alcohol anymore too,
so same here,
like I'm losing that. But I found that if you just drink some sparkling water, that nobody knows the difference, really. I fortunately don't have those type of friends who are like, come on, drink.
You got to give them so I do. I have some friends who
you do?
Give me
okay.
a hard time if I don't have
because you like grew up here, so you still have like kind of the high school people who maybe they went a different way in life, but
they
you
moved
still...
away. I'd have some friends, you know, not from high school, but they live here, and some of them give me some guff if I don't have a beer with them, and I just like drink a pop or whatever. But I found that if you make a really weird excuse, it can work, like, or if you're really ambiguous, like if you say I can't drink anymore, and you just leave it at that. Maybe they assume like that you're
an
AA or something. You have some medical condition. Actually, this is super tangential, but it reminds me of the ultimate hack for avoiding the TSA, the cancer machine at the airport.
Oh, okay.
If you opt out,
I opt out almost
every time.
Unless
you have
I'm in
to.
A huge hurry, just I always opt out.
You have to. It's like the one political thing I do.
Yeah, me too. I'm not really a big.
So I got this tip from this guy who just says he's like the opt-out expert. He has like a blog on it, a whole blog.
This is fascinating.
So he says his ultimate hack that works every time is I can't lift my arms. Because you know you have to lift your arms when you go in the machine. So he just says I can't lift my arms. And they don't even blink. They just say, okay, go through the metal detector.
Oh, they don't even do the pat-down then.
No pat-down. You just go through the metal detector. I've never had the guts to do this, so your mileage
because
may vary.
Because if you can't lift your arms, you can't really do the pat down either. Because the pat down requires putting your arms out.
That is true.
Because I was going to say you don't have to say that you have to lift your arms, because actually in my experience, the TSA, with maybe one or two exceptions, and I travel quite a bit, the TSA agents, if you say I would like to opt out, they don't give me any flack at all. I've been very impressed.
Generally, sometimes they get unprofessional and say, why are you opting out? It's not going to change anything.
I have
kind of fatalistic.
Had to say, like, you know that it doesn't cause cancer or something. I'm like, yes, I know that. And I don't tell them why I'm opting out or if I could even communicate that. I don't even know if I could. But just I'm opting out, and it's kind of neat that this is one of these freedoms that we still have.
Right.
Like we could opt out of the pat down. But not lifting the arms, You know, there's been times where I've, you know, working out or something, maybe I had to do too many pull-ups or something, you know, and I
can't lift your arms.
Can't lift my arms.
There you go. And it's not like they're going to say why, because that could be a sensitive answer that you can't say publicly. So, yeah. And maybe one day I'll give it a shot.
You should try it on your way to Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Well, there's also, I don't know how much you travel, but TSA PreCheck. I think you don't even have to do that.
You know, you have to. It's so tempting, but I don't want to.
On principle.
On principle.
Okay, on
yeah.
principle.
I don't judge people who do it, but.
No, I understand.
Principle.
Like it's like they're making money off of making it more convenient for a certain class of people to be able to, you know, to go through the airport lines faster. Yeah, no, totally. I get that.
I just heard something about France when they launched their original high-speed trains, the TGVs. They had the option of making them like twice as expensive, but they deliberately made them the same cost as the old lousy slow trains. And they said it's because we have this French principle that you shouldn't have to pay for something better. It should be equal to all.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, yeah.
Really got me. I was like, wow, yeah, go French people. And we would never see that in the in America. Exactly. The TSA pre is exactly like the kind of bad thing that we do.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And that reminds me, though, there's some public transit. I know a lot of public transit systems will purposely have like a flat fare no matter how far you're
like
going,
Chicago.
Mm-hmm. It would, you know, it transfers 25 cents or something like that, because then it's like, you know, if you have to live further away from work because you can't afford it, then it's at least
you don't get penalized.
There's at least that, right? You at least get that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
By the way, there's a SoundSlice tie-in here.
Yeah. Please.
For our teacher product, students don't pay anything. So the teacher pays $20 a month. You can use it with as many students as you want. And I see that as like a moral and ethical thing. So there's competing products where you're charged based on the number of students you have, and the student has to pay for it. And in a lot of cases, students can't pay for it. They're low income. And I see that as an ethical problem. Like these companies shouldn't be penalizing people who can't afford it.
Yeah.
So
this is, I'm glad that you brought that up, because this is one of the things that I think is so important for people like yourself, or what's so great about people like yourself who are able to run their own business is that you can run it according to your own values.
That's the one of the very best things about it. Yeah. That is priceless. It is absolutely priceless. I can just unilaterally make a decision that, you know, that is in line with my own values.
And you don't have to justify it to anybody. There's no shareholders that are going to sue you or anything like that.
Right.
You can just say, well, this is what's important to me.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, for myself, like the mobility, being able to travel, that sort of thing is important.
So it's priceless. Make it,
what are some of the, what do you think some of your guiding values are then that, guide your decision making in your endeavors?
Independence.
Yeah.
I want to be able to make those sorts of decisions without having to answer to anyone. And that sort of permeates everything. So from the decisions of where to live, that's actually why I like living in Chicago. I refuse to move to the Bay Area despite a lot more opportunity for tech.
Yeah,
I think if you move out there...
I actually moved from there to here.
Sure. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're kind of selling out if you move there. No offense.
I grew up in Nebraska, so I was willing to go anywhere. And
it was
an accident that I ended up there. But
So I think you should live where you like
to live. Not that I'm defensive about it.
Right. You should live where you like to live, not because it's where it's trendy or... know, for some reasons that aren't, I want to live here because I like to live here.
Yeah.
That independence colors a lot of my own thinking about these sorts of things. And also wanting to do something that benefits society as opposed to something that's maybe would make more money but is evil. And also, like, the need to be passionate about what I'm working on. So, you know, the so-called serial entrepreneurs, where they do, you know, business after business, and they just keep starting new things, and then they get them to some point, and then they either sell them off or, you know, whatever, they get rid of them in some way. And it's almost that they don't care about the nature of what the product actually is. They just see it as a business. They see it for all, like, the MBA things, like, oh, this is the cost of acquisition. This is the unit cost. This is the marketing cost. And they don't even care whether it's music or, you know, financial services or whatever the heck kind of business it is. I envy that because I can never do that. And I feel like I'm a worse off business person because I can't just close my eyes in terms of the type of product. But I also, so that's my Achilles heel as a business person.
That's one of the funny paradoxes I think about entrepreneurship or those type of entrepreneurs that I've seen, where I always have thought, like, well, you know, if you're going to do an entrepreneurial endeavor and build a company, you're going to have to work super hard.
And you have to care about it.
And how can you work that hard if it's not something you care about?
Right.
And then bring along with that, well, if you care about it so much,
why do you want to get rid of it someday and flip it?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one of those things that's always kind of fascinated me about the, you know, the entrepreneurial flipping.
The Silicon Valley scene.
I mean, I think that maybe some people, they just truly love building things. And, like, they just love that part of the process so much that, you know, a company, it has a life cycle to it, where in that beginning part, there's all this
nebulous stuff that you've got to,
and then there becomes these processes that aren't as exciting. But, I don't know, can you run a business and keep that excitement alive time and time again if you're willing to take some risks, perhaps?
The 37 Signals guys are a huge inspiration to me.
Yeah.
For this.
Yeah, they keep it fresh, but they've doubled down on Basecamp, where, you know, now it's Basecamp, right?
Right.
Just Basecamp. So.
Yeah. Just, well, I meant like them working on the same thing forever and not selling out, and
they keep it interesting to themselves, I think, you know. Because they have their own values there and they're not trying to please their shareholders or something.
Right.
That's a conversation I should try to get
Jason
someone.
And David.
Yeah, that would be really cool. So this is going to be an incongruent question, but what was the last book that you read that changed the way that you saw something?
Journey to the Ants.
Okay.
It is a book about ants. Just finished it a couple weeks ago. These two ant scientists, I forget the word for ant scientist, but there is a word. They wrote a book called Ants that won, I think, the Nobel Prize or Pulitzer, one of those, for science writing. And it was like the definitive collection of everything humanity knows about ants. And it, you know, was hugely successful in the scientific community, but it was not meant for, like, just lay people to read. So a couple of years later, they distilled it into this more pop book called Journey to the Ants. And it's all about how ants work, and it was fascinating. My wife and I always read before going to sleep in bed at night, and every page I would be like, ants are awesome! And my wife got so tired of hearing that, but it
and you're sitting there trying to explain what you just read,
or... She would never let me. She's like, save it for dinner tomorrow. But yeah, it was so good. Maybe it doesn't answer your question, because you asked
why. I think that it does.
What the last book that
changed the way you saw ants, probably, and I'm sure there might be some parallels.
Definitely, there's so many fascinating things about them, man. They are amazing. I highly recommend this book. But maybe something that's a little more on the head. Let's see. There's a book I read recently called The Time Paradox. You know this?
No, I'm not familiar with either of these books. So
it's
I'm glad to get these book recommendations.
You know Derek Sivers from CD Baby?
Yes. I don't know
Derek. I don't know him either, but I know of him. So he has an awesome page on his website that's just his book recommendations.
Yeah.
And it's hundreds of books. So I just like go down his list and read as much of his high-rated stuff as I can.
Yeah.
Anyway, this time paradox is about how almost all of, well, the hypothesis is that almost all of human behavior can be explained by your time mentality, your worldview in terms of time. Are you future oriented? Are you present oriented? Yeah. Or are you past oriented? And there's are you happy about the past? Are you sad about the past? Are you happy about the present? Are you content about the present? Are you excited about the future?
I've seen like one of these whiteboard animations on YouTube where somebody's talking about this sort of thing, and they're basically saying that people who live close to the equator are more present oriented.
Uh-huh.
Because the weather's nice and they don't have to, you know, if you live in Chicago, you have to be a little bit more future oriented because mm-hmm. you've got a plan.
Got to look forward
for the
to something.
Winter's coming and you're going to have to prepare for it.
Totally.
And those sort of things. So is that.
Yeah. According to the book, it explains a lot of human behavior, everything from terrorism to, bunch of bad stuff like shootings, mm-hmm. But also happy stuff, and it really changed the way I think about human motivation. I think maybe it's a little simplistic, but it was very convincing.
I mean, painting in broad strokes, I spend a lot of time in Colombia, and mm-hmm. the mentality of people is completely different there. There's just, and I love it. Like when I first get there, it's an adjustment for me because everybody's just kind of slow and like not mm-hmm. by my standards, they're slow. They're not concerned about hurrying with anything, and you know, maybe a little bit unreliable from time to time or something. But then over the course of a couple of months, I get into that rhythm, and when I come back to Chicago, I feel like I'm, you know, for a couple of months or so, I'm still operating on that, and it's. It's so awesome. I love it. Some of it sticks with me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how Holland affects me.
Yeah, do you have any predictions? And maybe you'll be able to listen to this 18 months from now. And
interesting, yeah. Well, I've read a couple of books on Dutch culture, and well, it's very direct, and there's not a lot of like fake niceties. Mm-hmm. And I tend to be like that.
I could do without fake niceties.
Totally.
As well.
Yeah. Right? I think it's kind of Midwestern. There's a lot of similarities to Chicago with the the Dutch sentiment. But
I was just in New York for a month, and I enjoyed the directness.
The directness.
Yeah, actually.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that will color how I and my family relate to one another. And let's see. I think I'll be very self-conscious about just my accent and being an American there, even though it's a city full of transplants, Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm going to be, I'll turn more self-conscious and kind of quiet, because at first I won't want to be like really be myself. I want to try to fit in, but eventually I'll feel more comfortable in my skin there.
Yeah, there is definitely, from my experience, a little bit of that where you're sort of acting in passive mode a little bit, where you're just kind of like letting the world around you act upon you because you don't really know how you yourself
exactly
should be acting. And then
You get to know how people do things.
Yeah, then right or wrong, you develop some sort of framework about how things are there.
Hopefully right, yeah.
I mean, I don't think you can ever be right about
it.
Yeah,
unless you are native, yeah.
Though I found for myself, I love the repetition of going to another place and going through that process and then coming back to my home And then there'll be things where I'll sort of find where I might have an idea that like, oh, this is the way Chicago people are.
Yeah.
And then I'll go to this other culture, and over time I'll start to observe like, okay, maybe I was wrong about that. Maybe this is just a people thing.
Yeah.
One of the other great things about it is then, you know, you might discover this new thing just because it's a type of food or something, and it just happens to be more available in the place where you're spending that time. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh God, I wish I had this in Chicago, or I wish I could get this in Chicago. And then you come back and, oh, you find that you actually can find it. It's just that you had no idea. You didn't have any cognizance of it because it wasn't there in front of you. But you're going in deep. You're going for 18 months, so...
Yeah, man.
What do you think the chances are that you'll just, you know...
Want to stay?
Assimilate and stay.
I would put it at 30%.
Okay, that's pretty high.
I don't know... So we have it nice in Chicago. We have a lot of family here, a lot of friends, got a house. We're going to move from having a house and then a car, which we use occasionally, to no car, living in a European city in a probably very small place, walking everywhere and biking everywhere. But it's going to be a big lifestyle adjustment. And I wonder whether I'm going to miss having more space. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether I'm going to miss being someone who fits in and not being an outsider. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, no matter how long, I mean, if I stay in Amsterdam the rest of my life, I'll always be an outsider. So that is something that I think about.
So a couple things there just from my own experience. One, the space thing for me, I've lived in big three-level penthouses in Colombia. And I've lived in didn't have very much space when I was in New York. So it was surprising. I don't know, like the when I was living in the big place, at first it was really cool. And I know that over time I started to feel like, well, I don't know if this is actually making me any happier.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. And sometimes it was annoying because I've got to go away upstairs because I forgot that thing. And like, and then in New York where I didn't have much space, it was an adjustment. It was, but I was, you know, working and sleeping in the same room is a tough thing at first for me. But
it may be a little different with kids. I mean,
yeah,
I need a space to practice guitar. And if I'm in like a one bedroom apartment with my wife and kid, practice is not going to happen after my kid goes to sleep. So it is nice having a little bit of space. And then also, like, it's been really nice here. So we have a guest bedroom. We've basically become the de facto hotel for visiting gypsy jazzers, and I've gotten to know a lot of the international gypsy jazz superstars. Well, it's a stretch to call them superstars, but, like, people who are really great in this style because they always stay with me in Chicago. So that's nice. And we're going to give that up. But it'll be good to have a change. We got rid of a lot of stuff. That's been really nice and healthy to just like, get rid of furniture. And like, I am in the process of selling all my CDs.
That's one thing I like about doing these things is when you leave, you have to do all this stuff that like you would never get around to if there wasn't some sort of a thing. And now I've got it down to where I'm so organized with it that I can very quickly get my place ready to go.
Nice.
You know, I've got like a place where I just throw stuff in this closet and lock it, and you know, it's pretty much ready to go.
Yeah.
So getting it down to a system, but yeah, get some household chores done. And since it's one way to motivate oneself, I think. To your point about being an outsider, that's an interesting one too, because I've actually thought about that a lot. Because I don't feel like an insider. In the United States, I don't feel like I belong.
Really?
I don't think I ever really have. And so I'm actually kind of comfortable. There's something I find comfortable about, you know, being in a foreign country and being an outsider. And actually, one of the things I've found that's great about that as well is that, and it might be different in Amsterdam, because Amsterdam, like you say, is a kind of a melting pot probably. But at least in like, say, Colombia or, you know, when I was in Buenos Aires, is that other expats, you just automatically kind of have this.
Yeah,
it's more of a bond, a rapport with
them. So what's the deal with that? Do you try to avoid expats to get like the authentic thing? No?
I don't. I mean,
isn't there a risk that you're going to be with expats every day and not really get the local flavor?
Yeah, I mean, there's a risk of that, but I'm pretty integrated. I've got, you know, Colombian friends and but the expats I find to be very very interesting too, because you know the type of person.
Yeah, it's self-selecting. Yeah,
it is very self-selecting. The type of person who will pick things up and who doesn't sit around and talk about this thing that they want to maybe do someday,
right,
and then actually goes and does it. There's this self-selection there. They're very interesting people, and then you also I get a sense that you all know that you kind of need each other. In a way. And there's like a Facebook group of expats where I go and there can be very simple things like, well, this isn't simple, but how do I open a bank account?
Right.
And there's just like people commenting and sharing all their knowledge. And it brings back for me what's beautiful about the internet in a way, mm-hmm, that has kind of gotten lost. It reminds me of being in an AOL chat room or something in the 90s, or you know, where there's people who are sharing things and they need each other, right? This, mm-hmm, is like a very human thing that that's the way direction technology is going, is just like trying to find how many different ways we can not need one another.
Right.
And I feel like being an expat in a foreign place brings some of that back. Huh. And I like it. So it might be something to look for.
Nice. I really appreciate that.
I can't thank you enough for sitting down with me and having this great chat today. And it's very refreshing to hear a creator that has a very well-defined way of doing things. And I'm really glad that you've arrived at something you feel like you can do for the rest of your life. And hopefully we can sit down again in 18 months or so if and when you come back from Amsterdam. Or maybe we'll sit down in Amsterdam.
See you sometime. In Amsterdam, yeah. Yeah.
So thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
So there we have it. Before I go, I gotta ask, do you like books? If you do, I'd love to send you my book recommendations. About 90% of them will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to academy.net/reading and make sure you put one more trailing slash on the end of that URL. Sign up and you'll get my first set of recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is CNU, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Academy, Inc.